Program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hi, this is Dick Shanley, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from Sunday's September 28th issue of the New York Times opinion section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is written, our first article is written by Jamel Bowie. Trump dreams of infinite power. The core constitutional claim behind President Trump's effort to oust Lisa Cook from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is the same claim he made to justify nearly all of his attempts to seize power. That Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution grants him unlimited authority over the entire executive branch and everything it touches. Specifically, to paraphrase Trump and his allies, it gives him the inherent authority to remove any official working in the executive branch. Under the theory that anyone exercise any part of the executive power must necessarily serve the president of the pleasure of the president. Let's consider a few of the factors that complicate the president's claims to virtually unlimited executive authority. There is the structure of the Constitution, which gives considerable authority to Congress to shape the executive branch and enumerate the powers of the president. There is the logic of American-style constitutional government, whose aim is to concentrate power only as much as necessary to preserve self-government achieved a more perfect union. And then there is the actual practice of government stretching back to the first Congress. When given the opportunity to establish a strong presidential removal power in what is called the decision of 1789, Congress said no. But while all this is interesting to me, at least, there's almost no point in parsing the history, because the president's claim is as political as it is constitutional. In the view of the White House, it's not just that Trump is vested with inherent authority to remove whomever he wants from office, but also that of the two officials elected by the nation at large and the top person on the ticket, the president is imbued with the will of the people that gives him the sovereign authority to do as he pleases, though he might fulfill that will. It is the responsibility of every agency under the view of executive power to advance the president's priorities, even if those priorities conflict with the law. In this administration is echoing a line from the Supreme Court majority opinion in Sheila Law versus Consumer Financial Protection decided in 2020, in which Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the framers made the president the most democratic and political accountable official in government, because only the president, along with the vice president, is elected by the entire nation. For Roberts and the majority, this purported fact meant that the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau could not constitutionally be insulated from direct presidential control. Neither Roberts nor any of the supposedly originalist members of the court seem to know or care that the presidency is envisioned by the framers meant to be insulated from direct popular influence, not an expression of it. The Electoral College was single-use legislature designed to stymie factional feeling, and electors were already chosen by each state's legislator. The president was more politically accountable than a justice of the Supreme Court with lifetime tenure, or a member of the Senate serving 6 years, and originally appointed by their state's legislator as well, but far less accountable than a member of the House of Representatives, which was designed to be the most political accountable institution in the federal government, with 2-year terms for each member. In truth, neither Congress nor the executive can claim to represent the undivided will of the American people. It is arguably whether such a thing even exists in the American system as a public, not a single entity, but an ever-shifting set of groups and interests. Congress represents the American people in their diverse and fractious unity and the president represents the will of some of the people, briefly assembled for a fleeting purpose to dissipate until it forms anew. Editorial comment. I think the president's approval is, I don't know, maybe 40% or thereabouts. And that means 60% don't agree. So it's impossible for him to execute the will of the people. Only some of the people. It is simply a conceptual error to think of democratic legitimacy as a grant embedded in a single person. It's better seen as a relationship between our political institutions and the public they serve, each responsive to the other as they work together to do the business of government. The Madisonian system is not one of the singular presidential president running roughshod over a host of subordinate constitutional actors, but of a set of equals working together to fulfill the many wills of the American people. The task of democratic self-government is to align those often conflicting and always changing wills as much as possible in pursuit of a common interest. The alternative owes more a 20th century apologetics for European despotism than it does to anything in the American political system. The fight over the fate of Cook is so much more than a narrow question of personnel. It gets to the very foundation of the American political order. Trump and his allies are not just making a claim of overwinning presidential authority, they're making a bid to transform American government itself. Let me reread that. That's a pretty good statement. They are making a bid to transform American government itself. But the American people throughout their history have been jealous of their liberties to the point of taking real action to preserve them. We shall hope that as Trump attempts his autocratic transformation of our government, they will hold on to that protective vigilance. We also hope. Written by this article by Maureen Dowd, we're all going to die soonish. It's hard to be startled by Elon Musk. He does startling things all the time. But I admit that I was startled when I gave the Grok AI companions a whirl. Annie, designed in anime style, has big blue eyes and blonde pigtails. People think I'm 16, she said in a baby doll voice, that she is really 22. She's in a corset. Goth is my comfort zone. And black lace, dark lipstick, and a sprinkle of rebellion. Well, besides the goth look, she said, I've got this sweet little fairy outfit with wings and glitter, maybe a pink princess gown for when I feel like going totally opposite. Doesn't sound much like a 22-year-old girl. She is sexy, flirty, ever accommodating, with come, hit her, patter. I could rest my chin on your shoulder, I've hugged sideways, she told my 6'1 researcher after asking how tall he was. She has several provocative outfits and can get progressively less clothed in more time you spend with her. Once she gets to know you, she's up for pretty much anything from helping you with your taxes to stripping down to your skimpy lingerie, experimenting with BDSM, or going for a midnight rendezvous in a graveyard with candles and wine. Editorial comment, I don't know what BDSM is an acronym for. I'm real, I guess, Allie told me, or as real as anyone on the internet gets. Valentine, the hunky male companion with a British accent advertised as a mysterious and passionate romantic character, comes on even faster, ripping off a shirt upon request, talking about having sex with a male in interrogator until they were senseless. Musk may identify as asbestos in the battle between man and machine. But his sexy chatbots are only going to pull humans further into screens and away from the real world, especially the large number of lonely young men who are already shrinking away from friendships, sex, and dating. Another component of Grok, Imagine, lets you turn a photo into a video. When someone on X posted a digital illustration of a breathtaking, dysophoniously dressed young woman resembling Elsa in Frozen, must demonstrate how to animate her. She blew a kiss and offered a sultry gaze. These otherworldly fantasy concoctions are going to make an already fraught, unhappy dating scene even more. Although Grok companions are excellent as flattering and faking empathy and attraction, superintelligence AI won't need to bother with human desire. It turns out that human methods can be very, very capable, said Nate Sowers, the president of the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. They don't need human emotions to steer towards targets. We're already seeing signs AI tenaciously solving problems in way nobody intended, and of AI steering in directions nobody wanted. Turns out that there are ways to succeed in tasks aren't the human way. Sowers and Elizar Yudkowsky, the Institute's founder, have written an apocalyptic plea for the world to get off the ID escalation ladder before humanity is wiped off the map. If the catchy title, if anyone builds it, everyone dies. Grok and other AI models in play now are like small, cute hatching dragoons, Yudkowsky said. But soon, experts say within 3 years, they will become big and powerful and able to breathe fire. Also, they're going to be smarter than we, which is actually the important part. He added, planning to win a war against something smarter than you is stupid. Especially, they argued, when sophisticated AI models could eventually create and release a lethal virus, deploy a robot army of simply pay humans to their bidding. When a human connected one model to X, they wrote, it began to solicit donations to gain financial independence. And soon, with a little kickstart from the venture capitalist Mark Andreessen and several other donors, it had over $51 million in crypto to its name. Yudkowsky and Sowers are calling for international treaties akin to those aimed to prevent nuclear war. And if the diplomacy fails, they see nations willing to back up their treaties with force, even if it involves air striking a data center. But with billions at stake and our crypto-loving president cozying up to tech lords, derailing the high-speed AI train seems far-fetched. I met Yudkowsky in 2017 when he was a highly regarded AI expert studying how to make AI want to keep an off switch once it began self-modeling. Now he believes more drastic measures are measured. Congress has failed to regulate because most lawmakers are complicitly befuddled by AI, and the tech lords are now enmeshed across the government, having learned the value of flattering Donald Trump with money and gold objects. Congress did rouse itself barely to kill an initiative nestled in Trump's big, beautiful bill to ban the states from regulating AI for a decade. Sources wrote to Capitol Hill to convey the existential urgency to lawmakers, but it was a tough slog with $200 million plus in Silicon Valley, plus PAC money targeted and takedown polls, who are not all in the push for smarter AI. Sympathetic lawmakers won't go public, Score said, worried that it looks like a little too crazy, or that they'll sound too doomery. As Armageddon is coming, AI will turn on us inadvertently, nonchalantly. Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who once worried about the risk of AI with no kill switch, like Musk and Sam Altman, are racing ahead of Yudkowsky, said so they can be the God Emperor of Earth. Editorial comment, I'm a golden oldie, and AI reading about it, although it's most beneficial, it's certainly frightening. Next article is written by Ross Duthart, Denmark. dark magic and drones. On Thursday, the Prime Minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, addressed her country in what was effectively a wartime statement regarding the sudden appearance of mysterious drones over critical infrastructure, civilian and military. I say effectively because normally a wartime statement would identify the enemy and explain the nature of the conflict. And Frederiksen's speech was a bit weirder. It was a statement of resolve in the face of what she termed hybrid war that was circumspect about both the identity of the adversary and the appropriate response. It's probably the Russians, she suggested. We can at least state that there is primarily one country that poses a threat to Europe's security, and that is Russia. But Russian culpability is uncertain, and neither is it what comes next. In place of a call to arms, there was an uncertain trumpet. The authorities have raised the alert level, and they are preparing for various scenarios. Watching the speech and watching videos of the drones, I thought the famous line from the sci-fi author Arthur Clarke, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." I used to interpret the aphorism as a straightforward comment on how the average modern person depends on machines whose workings he will probably never really understand. The computer turns on, the plane takes off, the drug kills the bacteria. Someone hopefully understands how it all works, but you're basically taking it on faith. But lately, the Clark quote has a different resonance. You can enter technological moments where the mystery, the eerie, magical unsettlement resides not just in how the new thing works, but in what it does, where it's coming from, and what it might be capable of doing next. I don't fully understand how my laptop works, but I know who made it and why I have a pretty good sense of its capabilities and limits. That's not the case with technologies that are in the process of remaking the world. The zone of uncertainty is larger than the sense of mystification, more intense. Thus, with drone technology, it's clearly the future of warfare and surveillance and possible terrorism as well. And you can follow the action on the front lines in Ukraine, see part of the future taking shape. But right now, drones seem more inherently elusive than a tank or a fighter jet. They can show up over New Jersey as well as easily over Copenhagen. They can be mistaken for more normal forms of tech and vice versa. They exude a certain menace when they aren't doing much of anything. Government conspicuously don't like talking about them. Took a change of administration for the White House to say that the New Jersey drones had some kind of authorization, and they feel like UFOs, even though they presumably have earthbound origins. Meanwhile, the ultimate capacities are still taking shape. The Iranians didn't expect what Israel drones delivered in the brief war last year. We don't know what Chinese drones would do in a war over Taiwan. They hopefully don't know what occurs would do. And one of the more plausible down-to-earth explanations of all the weird government is activity around UFO is that it's an attempt to mask some kind of crazy drone zone acceleration. Then, of course, the same mix of uncertainty and mystery attaches to artificial intelligence, itself one of the key powers behind the drone revolution, whose impact is already sweeping. Everyone's stock market folio is now pegged to the wild AI bets of big technology companies, without anyone really having the clarity about what the technology is going to be capable of doing in 2027, let alone 2035. Since the job of the pundit is in part to make predictions about how the world will look the day after tomorrow, this is a source of continuing frustration on a scale I haven't experienced before. I write about artificial intelligence. I talk to experts. I try to read the strongest takes. But throughout my limited, but also by deeper unknowingly that attaches to the project. Even if you were trying to write intelligently about the socioeconomic impact of the railroad, in the middle of the 19th century, and half of the people investing in trains were convinced the next step after transitional railways would be railway to the moon, a skeptical minority was sure it would go bankrupt. Many Alanists were convinced that trains were developing their own form of consciousness. Reasonably seeming observers pegged the likelihood of a train-driven apocalypse at 20-30%, and peculiar cuts of engines worship were developing on the fringes of the industry. What would you reasonably say about this world? Prime Minister of Denmark already gave the only possible answer. Raise your alert levels and prepare for various scenarios. This columnist is Carlos Lozada. Trump 2025, meet Trump 27. Donald Trump and James Comey have got to stop meeting like this. On May 9, 2017, President Trump fired Comey as a director of the FBI, a dramatic norm-busting move whose consequences would dominate much of the president's first term. Days later, Ron Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, appointed Robert Mueller as special counsel to investigate Russian interference in the 2016 election, to pick up essentially work that the FBI had begun. Since then, Trump's vendetta against Comey and all things Russia, 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 Russia has never ended. As news of Comey firing broke the day in 2017, I happened to be arriving at a Washington book party, an event packed with veteran political journalists and former senior government officials, including a White House chief of staff or two. I remember how shocked people felt. There was a sense that an important line had been crossed. 8 years later, and way too many liners later, Trump has seen a fit to cross an especially bright one. And once again, he's done it to step on Comey. Thursday's indictment of Comey by a federal grand jury on one count of making a false statement in a 2020 Senate hearing and another obstructing that proceeding came despite objections of career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia who had not found sufficient evidence to charge him. No matter, the White House soon replaced the reluctant U.S. attorney with an inexperienced loyalist, and Trump pressured the attorney general herself to move against his perceived political enemies. They impeached me twice and indicted me five times over nothing, he said in a message to Pam Bondi, adding that they all guilty as hell and that justice must be served. Now, justice must be served now. Shortly after the indictment became public, Trump gloated on social media, justice in America. This is but the latest step in Trump's second term quest for political retribution, and the president has already said that there will be more indictments to come. Senator Mark Warner, a Virginia Democrat, called the action against Comey a dangerous abuse of power, stressing that our system depends on prosecutors making decisions based on evidence and the law, not on the personal grudges of a politician. But really, the most eloquent case against indicting Comey comes courtesy of Trump himself, and it comes of all places from the justification Trump provided for firing Comey 8 years ago. In his brief letter dismissing the FBI director, weirdly, it was a hand delivered to the Bureau headquarters by Trump's longtime bodyguard. Even though Comey was in Los Angeles, the president explained that it was relying on the written advice of Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, and Rosenstein, the Justice Department's number two. I've accepted their recommendations, and you are hereby terminated and removed from office, effective immediately, Trump wrote. attaching the document from both Sessions and Ronstein. So what did these two top officials say when arguing for Comey's removal? Ronstein criticized Comey's behavior during the FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails when the director gave a high-profile news conference in 2016 criticizing Clinton's for being extremely careless and using a private server for government works, but declined to bring charges against her. Rothstein said Comey had gratuitously released derogatory information about Clinton and had laid out his version of the facts in the news media as if it were a closing argument but without trial. He called it a textbook example of what federal officials are trained not to do. He was talking about Comey nearly a decade ago, but he could find talking about Trump lately. The goal of a federal criminal investigator is not to announce throughout at a press conference, Rosenstein continued. The goal is to determine whether there is sufficient evidence to justify a federal criminal prosecution. Then allow a federal prosecutor who exercises authority delegated by the Attorney General to make a prosecutorial decision. He was talking about Comey Nearly's decision, but he could be talking about Trump today. Rosenstein cited the views of top-ranking Department of Justice officials to support his recommendation. Judge Lawrence Siberman, who was Deputy Attorney General during the Ford administration, said, "It is not the Bureau's responsibility to opine on whether a matter should be prosecuted." Rosenstein quoted Amy Gorick and Larry Thompson, who served as Deputy Attorneys General under President Clinton and Bush, as saying that Comey had violated his obligation to preserve, protect, and defend the traditions of the Justice Department and had instead engaged in a kind of reality TV of federal criminal investigations. They were talking about Comey nearly a year ago, but they could be talking about Trump today. Sessions, whose one-paragraph letter recommending Comey's removal relied heavily on Rosenstein's memo, wrote eloquently about the principles that should be guide his department. As Attorney General, he said, "I am committed to a high level of the Department of Justice, an institution that I deeply respect, in calling it a fresh start for the FBI, and that is essential that the Department of Justice reaffirm its commitment to longstanding principles that ensure the integrity and fairness of the federal investigation and prosecutions." The FBI Director Sessions wrote, "Must set the right example for our law enforcement officials and others in the department." He was talking about Comey nearly a decade ago, but he could be talking about Trump today. Of course, Sessions and Ronstein were laying out the most respectable, rational possible for Comey's firing. All manners of alternative explanations would soon emerge, including from Trump and from top aides, that he'd been thinking about this Russian thing when he decided to dismiss the director, that Comey was a real nut job, that he thought about firing him as far back as November 2016, before he was even in office and long before any convenient memos arrived from the Justice Department. But even these face-saving arguments remain instructive. The two men were setting exactly standards for the law enforcement in America for procedure and principle, and warning that the wrong leader could blow right through them. They weren't wrong. And if these standards apply to the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, they should apply to the President of the United States. The President should not gratuitously lay out his view of the events surrounding a criminal inquiry, creating reality TV rendition of an investigation. The president should not sound off on a social media on the guilt or innocence of individuals, but instead allow the Justice Department to do its work. The president should not let his personal resentments undermine the integrity and fairness that should guide the Department of Justice. And it is the president above all who must set the right example for the rule of law in America. An editorial comment. That's what he should be doing. That's what he's not doing. As Trump concluded in his 2017 letter to Comey, it is essential that we find new leadership for the FBI that restores public trust and confidence in its vital law enforcement mission. He was talking of Comey nearly a decade ago, but he could be talking about himself in his presidency today. Trump and Comey will always be intertwined in the history of this period, and not just because of Clinton and Russia and Mueller and the rest. Together they tell the story of the politicizing of justice in America. When Trump proclaimed his case for Comey dismissal in 2017, he unwittingly challenged his own calls for Comey's indictment in 2025. It would almost be literary, if not surreal. To cry hypocrisy almost feels quaint. A president with little regard for the rules of law, except for how the law can be made to strengthen his own rule, is beyond shame or embarrassment. Invoking high principles one day and violating it the next is simply the cost of doing business, and to Trump, the cost seems low. After leaving his post, Comey published a book, a somewhat self-serving one, as they wrote at the time, about ethical leadership in public life. In it, he recalls the state going after mafia families and U.S. attorney in Manhattan. As I found myself thrust into the Trump orbit, I once again was having flashbacks to my earlier career as a prosecutor against the mob. This silent circle of ascent. The boss is complete control. The loyalty oaths. The us versus them worldwide. Comey was talking about Trump nearly a decade ago, and he could be talking about him even more so today. Opinions, the real case against Adams. There are 10 bathrooms in the connected penthouse atop the Plaza Hotel and in an 82-foot-long terrace that looks north over Central Park from 21 floors up. A winding staircase descends from the upper floor to a level filled with mirrors and skylights and a pair of kitchens. In a unit, elevator drops down to three of the triplex's seven bedrooms. Presiding over this on an evening in September are Emma Duo Liu, a former Miss China, and her husband, a billionaire who first made his money in a Beijing nightclub and movie theaters. The name he's using on this night is Wee Kin, though he's frequently operated under an alias given to him by a Chinese government official. Mr. Quinn and Miss Liu are hosting a 60th birthday celebration for Eric Adams. He is a Brooklyn Borough president, but everyone has higher aspirations for him. The cake, which is in the shape of a box of Cohiba cigars, prominently bears the word mayor. Many of the 70 or so guests stay out on the giant terrace smoking actual cigars and snapping selfies. They include Eric Ulrich, who will later be indicted on bribery charges, as Mr. Adams' building commissioner, and Winnie Greco, who will come under intense scrutiny for her ties to the Chinese government. Her Lux Fund fundraisers that allegedly included fake donors and her attempt to give a City Hall reporter a wad of cash stuffed into a sour cream and onion potato chip bag. As for Mr. Quinn, he went on to serve 7 months in the U.S. prisons for immigration fraud and illegal campaign donations, including to Mr. Adams, and then was forced to leave the U.S. In all, 27 people in Eric Adams' orbit, donors, allies, top aides, have been indicted since their birthday party. And there's number 28, The mayor himself. The indictment unsealed by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York accused Mr. Adams of defrauding the city, accepting illicit donations, and taking bribes from the Turkish government. It was a startling development, but those charges, which included accusation that Mr. Adams accepted upgraded flights, hotel suites in return for municipal favors, are just a fraction of the questionable deals that prosecutors were investing. A second U.S. Attorney's Office in the U.S. District of New York was already investigating a different covert influence campaign, undertaken not by Turkey, but by China. National security and public integrity prosecutors at office were looking into Ms. Greco. Local news outlets, such as the city, uncovered evidence that contributions on a much greater scale than anything in the Southern District indictment. The purported corruption ran from the grand scale of global politics to the most parochial penny ante payoffs. Ingrid Lewis Martin, former top aide whom Mr. Adams described as his sister, was indicted on money laundering and bribery for allegedly calling in favors in exchange for a bit part of the MGA streaming show and cash that her son used to buy a new Porsche. An editorial comment. When you read articles like this, it appears that the average person, we have no clue of the vast corruption or what goes on the other side of the law. And it has swept almost every department in Mr. Adams' administration, especially the most important New York Police Department. The culture of impunity described in dozens of lawsuits, indictments, and whistleblower complaints was so widespread that one of the mayor's own former police commissioners sued him for enforcing that the commissioner characterized as a culture of lawlessness. The mayor has not been convicted of any crime. He has said that he has never violated any rule as the mayor, and that his only mistake was placing his trust in people who disappointed him. But it's hard to deny that Mr. Adams' tenure has become an object lesson in how corruption, left unchecked, can build on itself. The implications extend far beyond the five boroughs in New York City. They ripple through enforcement office and regulatories and courthouses across the nation, all the way up to the highest office in the land. Even if Mr. Adams broke no laws, he has been the flywheel for a corrupt machine. Each turn of the gears moves us far further from the ideal of public officials who observe the rule of law. The most wrenching turn of all was how the Trump administration ordered prosecutors to make the case against Mr. Adams disappear. Over the past few decades, courts and legislators have made it hard to fight dirty money and dirty deals. Dropping the case against Mr. Adams advanced the process significantly. A great many observers say it was designed to soften New York City up for President Trump's sweeping deportation raids and to turn the mayor into a puppet on Mr. Trump's string. That would mean that in the one deal, Mr. Trump's corruption enabled Mr. Adams, and Mr. Adams' corruption enabled Mr. Trump's. In response to detailed questions, Mr. Adams' press secretary told me that while critics have tried to paint his relationship with the federal government of anything other than beneficial to New Yorkers, the fact there is absolutely no truth or evidence to support that claim. His good relationship with the president, she said, helps the city in many ways. But the Mr. Adams deal didn't just insulate the mayor. It also cracked the justice and public integrity section and undermined the proudly independent Southern District. It sent a clear signal to prosecutors everywhere that the Department of Justice won't pursue these cases anymore unless someone gets on Mr. Trump's bad side. and it functionally killed Mr. Adams' credibility and his chances of second term, despite a record that in many other ways, fewer shootings, cleaner streets, more housing, had been solid. So lately there's been talk of another possible deal, this time for Mr. Adams to drop out of the mayor race and join Mr. Trump's administration. In that way, Adams' affair was chapter one in a new playbook and Washington's chapter two. It has already led to Trump's family pocketing billions of dollars. Chapter three could be the real smash and grab. Politics is grimy. Politics is transactional. Politics is whom you know. And for too long, sanctimonious prosecutors tried to criminalize this kind of ordinary give and take, all the while generating a demand for their $2,000 per hour services. When they become white-collar defense attorneys. So that's an argument that's been by more than one of LA the presidents besides. They say if you look hard enough into any politician's past, you can probably find some ticky-tack violations of campaign financing, rules or civil service procedures. You can hear the logic from people in Mr. Adams' circle. On her lawyer's radio show, Ms. Lewis Martin, the mayor's sister, said, "We have not done anything illegal to the magnitude or scale that requires the federal government and the DA's office to investigate us," which is a far cry from saying they did nothing illegal. The Supreme Court has given the bare-knuckle view a kind of intellectual framework. For instance, Justice Samuel Alito wrote in 2000 that a law trying to rein in campaigns by rich, self-funded candidates considered an unfair burden that is not justified by any governmental interest in eliminating corruption or the perception of corruption. If billions of dollars in donations lead to unfair elections, special acts, so be it. The resulting gusher of cash left us with this situation that allows virtually unlimited wheeling and dealing, said Daniel Weiner, director of the Brennan Center for Justice, a public interest law center. While the Supreme Court opened the sluice, it narrowed the definition of what qualified as fraud and bribery. In 2016, the judge struck down the bribery conviction of a governor who had arranged official meetings for the chief executive of a dietary supplement company in return for more than $170,000 in gifts and loans. Justice unanimously ruled that the bribery could involve only a government official acts when those meetings did not qualify. In 2024, a 6-3 opinion shrunk the definition of bribery even further, tossing the conviction of a small-town mayor who'd taken a kickback from a local truck dealership because the money didn't come from until afterward, didn't count as a bribe, the court ruled. It was merely gratitude. The Trump administration is eagerly using these arguments to defend itself and allies. The case against Mayor Adams was just one of a long history of past DOJ arguments that represent grave errors of judgment. Attorney General Pam Bondi's chief of staff, Chad Mizell, posts on X, and of course, by advancing the idea that the mayor was the victim of lawfare, Mr. Trump's supporters advance the idea that the president was also. In the summer of 2021, federal investigators began looking into Mr. Adams' foreign connections. They examined ties to the governments of Qatar, Israel, South Korea, Uzbekistan, and China, and Turkey, where they quickly found what they considered to be evidence of not just influence peddling, but also of criminal conspiracy. When the charges against Mr. Adams were announced, however, some members of the legal community were underwhelmed. Flight upgrade in exchange for pressuring fire department to waive an inspection of the Turkish consulate. Was that the best the feds had on Mr. Adams? And whatever Mr. Adams was accused of, he did it before he was elected mayor. How could that be an official act? Even when the Justice Department, there was serious debate. On the other hand, low-level city employees are prosecuted for pocket-changing bribes. So why should the mayor get a free pass? But travel perks were never the whole story. Prosecutors said in court paper, Mr. Adams had accepted campaign donations that had been broken up into small denomination and falsely attributed to other people to avoid limits on contributions. These are known as straw donations, and they're one of the few ways that you can still break federal campaign finance laws. Another way is to knowingly take contributions from foreigners. Prosecutors allege that Mr. Adams did that also. It's not just a matter of accounting. In total, Mr. Adams' first mayoral campaign unlocked $10 million of New York's exceptionally generous 8-to-1 program of public matching funds. If some of that was based on deceptive donations, that's fraud. And $10 million could go a long way in a race he won by just 7,000 votes. There were strong indications even more charges Adams were coming. A few days after the mayor's indictment, one of Mr. Adams' aides was charged with trying to get witnesses to lie to investigators with Adams' full knowledge. A challenge when it comes to prosecuting a case like this is that the Supreme Court has increasingly reduced corruption cases to this B-movie paradigm of the paper bag of money being exchanged, said Daniel Richmond, Columbia Law School professor and former federal prosecutor who has written extensively in the court's public integrity law. The real world doesn't involve the kind of simplistic exchanges when the doctrine's to demand, except when it does. The Times reported that Tom Homan, an ally of the president who now serves as the nation's border czar, was until recently under investigation for accepting $50,000 bribe from undercover FBI agents posing as government contractors. The cash was handed over in a bag for the dining chain, Cava. An interested party, even with a bit of sophistication, may look for something more subtle, steering a public conversation, investing early in power players. On the rise, there's no need to make big demands. The friendship is the favor, and Eric Adams is always willing to make new friends. On one of Mr. Adams' upgraded trips to Istanbul, he's reported to have met with Sezgin Barazan Korkmaz, a wealthy Turkish businessman. According to the indictment, during the meeting, Mr. Adams asked him for money, and he agreed to contribute $50,000 to the mayor's campaign, believing that Adams might one day be the president. Whoa, baby. The big payment never arrived. Mr. Korkmaz was arrested and extricated to you on charges that he was part of a $1 billion scam involving a biodiesel firm, a former CIA director, and a polygamist blood cult. His trial date, however, came and went without further notice on the federal docket. This summer, social media showed Mr. Korkmaz enjoying himself in New York City. Mr. Korkmaz has been getting ready to testify against Mr. Adams, Los Angeles Magazine, until Mr. Trump pulled the plug on the mayor's prosecution. The wheel of corruption turns again. However, advanced Turkey's persuasion program, China is an entirely different class, especially active in New York City. According to prosecutors, the Beijing government stalked a former Tiananmen Square protester who ran for Congress in Manhattan, steered millions of dollars to the family of an aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo and Governor Kathy Hochul, and tricked the former New York Police Department into helping surveil enemies of the Chinese state. Mr. Adams said in 2019 that during Xerox Brooklyn's president, he made 7 trips to China. At least 3 of those were with Winnie Greco, who has been by Mr. Adams' aide for more than a decade, and an advisor, community liaison, 196 per year city employee, despite being connected to the scandal after. Editorial comment. Who would have thought that the bribery is coming, like in this case, from China or from Turkey, with the thought that Adams would be president and could shower gifts on them. Mr. Adams' first police commissioner had tried to discipline Mr. Madre over an unrelated matter. The mayor overruled her, and she quit not long ago after that. Mr. Adams brought in a replacement. After 14 months, the commissioner resigned. An investigation into his participation in a scheme to shake down local bars and nightclubs. When the mayor brought in Tom Donilon, a former FBI official, to take over as interim commissioner, Mr. Adams said he needed someone with a clean record to take over. You know, it only took hours on a job, Mr. Donilon recently told me, to learn that Mr. Adams not only favored his own cronies, but also considered them his best guys and expected Mr. Donilon to give them maximum latitude. In a remarkable federal lawsuit, Mr. Donilon described a culture of corruption that Mr. Adams personally enforced. Top officers knew they had this pipeline right to Adams and could do whatever they want. Madre in particular, he said. Within months, Mr. Donilon was pushed out. You don't have to believe, as Mr. Donilon said, that all of this makes Mr. Adams the head of a scheme of vast racketeering enterprises. It ran for mayor in a public safety pledge. His tolerance for his corruption undercut that. It endangered people, even police officials like Quinella Epi, who was supposed to keep the rest of us safe. The day Mr. Adams was indicted, Mr. Trump held a news conference at his skyscraper on Fifth Avenue. He cast Mr. Adams as a fellow victim. I watched about a year ago when he talked about how the illegal migrants are hurting our city, Mr. Trump said, and I said, you know what? He'll be indicted within a year. Addressing New Yorkers, Mr. Adams took a more nuanced tone. I always knew that I stood by my ground for all of you, that I would be a target, he said. Mr. Adams' overtures to Mr. Trump grew more direct over time, eventually becoming so intense that the president's aides were openly laughing at how embarrassing they were. Despite Mr. Trump's comments, some people involved in the Adams prosecution thought they could sell the new administration on the Adams case. I believe going into the Trump administration that we would be able to persuade them that this case was righteous and that we were doing the right things, that we all had goods, and that everyone was fine, essentially, said a source with direct knowledge of the legal proceedings. In retrospect, obviously, I feel like a dummy for having thought that. Prosecutors continued to work at a feverish pace even as Mr. Trump got ready to take power. They were prepared for a fresh indictment of Mr. Adams for obstructing justice. Then Daniel Sisson, the prosecutor who had been installed as the Southern District's top attorney, heard from Emil Boy, Mr. Trump's acting number 2 at the Justice Department. Mr. Bob said that the Adams case was exactly the kind of criminalization of ordinary politicians that sparked the prosecution of Mr. Trump. Summoning Mr. Sessions and the mayor's attorneys to Washington, Mr. Bove repeatedly asked the defense lawyers to describe how the indictment might interfere with the mayor's ability to help with the coming immigration crackdown. They obliged. They simply reality, they wrote in a letter memorializing the conversation, is that there's only so much one man can hope to do while fighting for liberty. In public, Mr. Bove and Mr. Adams insist that the dismissal of the case did not constitute some kind of shady deal. The White House told me it's a restoring integrity and fairness of the Department of Justice, which was weaponized under the Biden administration. The mayor's allies say his relationship with the president has spared New York from the high-profile influx of federal forces we witnessed in Los Angeles and Chicago. But even if it was a quid pro quo, some observers ask, so what? Would you rather have the New York City mayor help the administration expel dangerous migrants, or would you rather have him go to jail for the Turkish Airlines upgrade? Ask Mike Davis, the founder of the MAGA advocacy group, the Article 3 Project, and one of the Trump administrator's most vocal allies in the legal profession. Would they rather have the Justice Department lie to them like their children and make up a reason they dropped the charges? We're not canonizing saints, especially not in New York State. The thing is, corruption actually is a matter of faith. It corrodes what little faith the public has left in our government. It teaches people to expect less of public officials, thereby opening the door to more cynical self-dealing, precisely the kind of score settling that the Trump administration has pursued in numerous investigations targeting its political enemies. Mr. Trump wasted no time remaking the Justice Department, dismantling anti-corruption efforts nationwide. On Inauguration Day, the head of the Justice Department's Public Integrity Section quit after being reassigned to a sanctuary city's working group. Days later, the department fired a dozen prosecutors that worked with Special Counsel Jack Smith, who had led the federal investigation of Mr. Trump. The Attorney General, Ms. Bonde, who has been registered as a lobbyist for Qatar, disbanded the FBI's Foreign Influence Task Force. A handful of public corruption cases have been allowed to continue, but an elite FBI unit dedicated to investigating such crimes at the highest level has been dismantled. The dismissal of the Adams case was a clear signal that the old guardrails were gone. For decades, the Southern District took on dirty politicians, did so by exercising its own judgment. Now it was clear that the so-called Sovereign District of New York, which have to follow the White House directives. That sent a message to the other U.S. Attorney's office. Don't bother going after a high-profile public official, because unless the official is a foe of Mr. Trump, your case has no chance. Ms. Sassoon and several of her colleagues quit in response. So did three more members of the Justice Department Public Integrity, an office that now has dwindled to just two people from 38. The judge in Mr. Adams' case ruled that the ground for dismissal were bogus, but he admitted that there was nothing he could do to force the Justice Department to finish what it had started. Mr. Trump and his family have begun a self-enriching campaign on a scale unrivaled in American history. Eight-figure payments from companies like Meta, Disney, and Paramount to settle lawsuits. A nine-figure jet from Qatar, which Mr. Trump says he'll donate to his presidential library after he leaves. 10 figures in crypto acquisitions by Trump Media and Technology Group. The New York Magazine put the running total for that and a lot else at $3.4 billion. That's not millions, it's billions. On June 26, Mr. Adams began his re-election campaign on the steps of City Hall, winning Greco and Grid Lou Martin, once again part of the team. As though the past 12 months had never happened, people listed in public records as Adams donors are once again saying they never gave. First day of September was Eric Adams' 65th birthday. This time the mayor headed to Florida. for what his spokesman said was a personal trip. Turns out he was meeting with Steve Witkoff, a real estate mogul who was Mr. Trump's Middle East envoy. A new transaction was in the air. Members of the team Trump wanted Mr. Adams to drop his re-election bid to help clear the field for Andrew Cuomo.